UFO file represents the maximum peril when it comes to President Trump and his initiative around releasing the files. It's not, you know, Hegseth was putting a little gray alien head in his Twitter feed. Look, I don't know if that guy has a clue or not, but this is a very serious, major issue, and he must know it on some level that that whole system, and if they try to negotiate with the system and say, well, we want to let a certain amount of this out, that system is sitting there in the background, and they have developed now for 8 decades an entirely different setup of breakaway technology. Now, how do you come back to the public and say, well, you know, we were doing this in the background, we did it with your money, and we have the infrastructure, we have the power now, but don't worry about it because we were protecting you from, you
know. Sure, somebody quantify that. He's not in full control of the UFO file, he's trying to, but by doing this, he puts himself politically in front, giving the capital to go in and get it.
And this is the key thing, that Trump needs to keep the initiative without losing his head over the fact that historically Obama or somebody else may score those points. Remember, Chuck Schumer was feeding Obama talking points about UFOs last year when they were trying to get legislation out there, and then they were going to have Obama grandstanding about it originally. In 2016, they were going to have Hillary Clinton do the whole UAP disclosure. That's where you got TTSA and Elizondo and all those people. That's the counterintelligence route. It's thin. It's actually very thin, but it's supported by that Central Intelligence Agency piece. They have the actual secret technology deep, deep in the halls of government. And I'll tell you, they're not. It's not the kind of thing, you know, once in a while you hear, hey, we found the location of this large UFO, you know, they put it in some building here or there. You're never going to hear about where these things are located. It is the top national security secret in the United States. And when you look at President Trump, he's someone who knows. And who does he know through? He knows through his relationship with President Nixon, which he had a very close relationship with him, which we revealed very much on our show. He knows through his close relationship with John Trump, and he knows through Roy Cohn. You know, you put those three together and you have a lot of where the deep state buried the bones. And this is, in my opinion, there's no question. This is why the incredible opposition on the national security state side to President Trump and his initiatives, which are leading towards a real, actual disclosure. The thing is, Trump likes to hold those cards very closely, and he does not have possession of the UFO file. This is the nature of the problem. Every president has looked, stared at the abyss of UFO disclosure and denied it because they realized the stakes were too high. The X-Protect group has been in charge, as I said, since the middle of the 1950s on that. There was a battle there very early on about what was going to come out. Forrestal and people like that were included. The dynasty of that is the JFK era because he saw how they unceremoniously dumped his friend, his best friend, Forrestal, out of a window. And he was the Secretary of Defense at the time. And famously, during one of his last speeches, he went to the actual gravesite of Forrestal and made sure to take pictures there. So Kennedy understood what he was up against. It's quite interesting. There's a character out there running these think tanks who was part of these think tanks at a certain point. Now she's giving commentary. Her name is Pippa Malmgren. Her dad was someone who was a staffer, a national security staffer in the Kennedy administration. Before he died, and I was communicating with him on X, he said clearly that he thought that the main reason that Kennedy was assassinated was over the UFO file and his willingness to share it with the Russians. Now, this is an old piece because remember, whenever these presidents get together with their counterparts in Russia, they try to keep them apart. And Trump asked, you know, I don't want any State Department people. I don't want any CIA people in there when I'm negotiating over the UFO file. This is what makes them, you know, hit the roof and say, oh, he was a traitor with Putin and all the rest of it. It's to keep those two forces together because the UFO file belongs under the executive branch. Right now, it's in the hands of the X-Protect group, which is intelligence, CIA, NGA, NRO. They control it. They're the ones who have it, and they certainly don't want to give it up for some Trump initiative. And so the idea was the Democrats were trying to make a deal with them, the Republicans through Trump. His side was trying to make a deal with them. And so Trump has the ability to go around them by doing his own announcement. That's the crucial step that he's taking. And it's historic because even his enemies will have to realize the potency of that kind of a move. And frankly, it represents a kind of maximum peril. I'll be honest with you about that. Clearly, there was a scientist who was assassinated just this morning.
think of John Worrell Keeley in this country with his very strange,
his inventions. The Keeley motor.
The contraptions that he's coming up with. Interestingly enough, when you read his explanations of them, they're kind of bland and blasé and mundane compared to some of the other kooky contraptions people are coming up with then.
It's a weird report of him demonstrating for the Army something that could go 500 miles an hour. Keeley's the one the report comes from, though, because it's just before flight, and just before all these things happen. First of all, he demonstrates levitating discs using musical notes.
Yes.
Also now, very strange.
Yes. That's exceedingly strange because you get a similar assertion tied to the airship.
Solomon Andrews was the guy you were thinking of.
Balloons. You get a similar idea of an auditory or sonic component in the airship mystery, because in some of those cases, Wilson comes off of those airships and then strikes a tuning fork, and then this thing levitates, which again is interesting. It's a little data point, because what do you have in Egypt? Well, you have the priests marching those big blocks into the pyramid, and they're blowing trumpets and so on and so forth. You know, so something's going on.
By the way,
sonic levitation is possible. You can go online, look at videos of them doing it in the laboratory. So,
you know. There go the walls of Jericho are coming.
Yeah, there go the walls of Jericho.
There is something weird back there with the Casey readings where he talks about the city and the Gobi. And the city and the Gobi, everything they used were audio defense. Mm-hmm. So they had developed... And they are kind of the colony after Mu, you know. They're the post-Lemurian colony goes in there. One of the strange features of that prediction is he talks about the city being entirely made of gold.
Wow. Just
sitting out there in the Gobi. And it's weird because in the Gurdjieff work, he goes on an expedition to the Gobi looking for a city of gold. So it's something that's around in that period and then... whoosh, you know, you just don't hear anything about it after the fact. But you're referring to in the 19th century, this stuff is coming up and it is kind of relating a type of mystical experience, psychic phenomena with the advances in technology and science.
Oh, definitely.
It's not divorcing them. And then by Freud and Einstein, you've got the divorce.
I think the divorce really settles in much earlier with Heaviside and his reworking, editing, to be kind to what he did, to Maxwell's equations. Mm-hmm. Because if you've ever read Maxwell wrote poetry. Most people don't know this, but James Clerk Maxwell actually wrote poetry. If you read it, it's very clear that Maxwell, just like virtually everybody else in the 19th century, he's got this mystical, metaphysical, spiritual thing going on with his approach to physics. And incidentally, his formulation of electromagnetism in quaternion algebra allows mathematically for that element to come into his theory. What Heaviside does is he takes that whole theory and recasts it in modern linear algebra, and he gets rid of that component. It's literally the scalar component that he gets rid of, and it's that scalar component in Maxwell that is that mystical, enfolded interior component. You know, and as a result of that, when you learn mathematical physics today, you are taught Heaviside's equations, and as part of that thinking, when you encounter a zero sum vector, you have a no translation vector, and that zero sum vector becomes equivalent with every other zero sum vector. Follow me?
Mm-hmm.
If you, however, draw vectors of equal length in a square rotating like that, what do you have? Well, you have a zero vector. It's a non-translation vector. It's not moving from point A to point B. It's a zero vector. But now if you have a hexagon where all the external arms of the hexagon are, again, vectors in a rotating system, is that a zero vector? Well, yes. But now look what mathematical physics does. It will tell you that one is equivalent to the other in terms of the math of the vector. It is. What they're doing is they're throwing out precisely what Maxwell was getting at, that interior infolded scalar component is not equivalent from one zero vector to another. And this is what Heaviside, this is a wow.
Yeah.
So Heaviside is getting rid of all of that. And by the way, when he does this, he goes on quietly in his private notes to keep experimenting with what Maxwell was doing.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah. So in other words, talk about occulted physics. They're trying to keep a lot of this stuff super secret.
It's a totally different line of physics.
Yeah, totally.
And you've talked before about the Nazis throwing out the book on physics and saying, give me everything.
Well, what Kammler does in the Kammler stuff, and I've tried to attempt to get people to understand the sweeping nature of what he does. Nazi Germany has been accused of not having made any advances in nuclear physics because it rejected Einstein and so-called Jewish physics, in other words, relativity. But what did that mean? That means they were forced back on their native-grown German physics. What was that? It was quantum mechanics, folks.
Right. Right. Okay. Yeah.
So if there's any branch of physics that has a lot to do with nuclear physics, it's not relativity, it's quantum mechanics.
Okay? Yes. Right.
So on top of doing that, Kammler also told his scientists and technicians, you do not have to pay a bit of attention to any Nazi party ideology. What I want you guys to do is brainstorm, think outside the box, map out the technology trees that we need to get from here to there. Okay, and that's all I want you to do. And on top of that, he freed them from the normal compartmentalization that goes on in Black Projects research, and he created a scientific journal, kind of a top secret magazine. All the latest exotic ideas from DARPA, you know, here in this top secret magazine. You can subscribe to if you've got clearance. Well, that's what Kammler did.
Wow.
He created this circulating magazine where the scientists could share their top secret papers and see what each other was up to. So he did the reverse of segmented compartmentalization of information. He wanted to create a climate in which you brainstorm, and anybody can brainstorm about anything. And that's what he did. Yeah. So he created the first DARPA. That's what he did.
Yes. Yes. It's incredibly innovative, and there's so many strange things about Kammler. We've done shows on Kammler and the Bell. I want to bring the Bell in here shortly. What I want to ask you, though, since you mentioned Kammler, is this. He's somebody who came out of engineering school, and he also would go through the dossiers and the backgrounds of the people and figure out how hardcore Nazi are you? If you're not, you're out.
Right.
And, but he was given, one of the things you point out is he was given total control over all the Nazi secret projects, including the Bell.
Yes. Yeah. He ran it.
I mean, that is, you know, obviously Hitler trusted him on a level that is beyond belief.
Hitler trusted him to an extreme level. And in fact, towards the end of the war, there are certain episodes where Himmler, Kammler's ostensible boss, is asking for the truck. And the truck, by the way, is codenamed for this massive six-engine Junkers 390, you know, heavy-lift, long-range aircraft that Himmler wants to get his hands on because he wants to get the heck out of Germany.
Make the best plane now.
Make the best plane now. And Collar just absolutely refuses to let him use it. Mm. He just said, nope, sorry, I've got it. You know, I've got plans for it.
Wow.
So, yeah. You know, and if there's anything that could have flown a lot of archival papers and a lot of equipment out of the Reich, it's the Junkers 39. I mean, this is a huge airplane, folks. It's kind of hard to miss.
Incredible.
Yeah, it is. It's just an enormous aircraft. It's like a B-36, you know. It's taking up the sky and blotting out the sun, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, Kommler is in charge of all the by the end of the war, all the Nazi secret research projects, every last shred of it. So, you know.
Basically disappears at the end of the war. False reports of his death. Four times.
Yeah, four times.
We're going to reverse. We're going to go backwards in time here on the Bell. Okay. So let's start with the Kecksburg crash, 1965. You get this crash in this small town in western Pennsylvania, again, near the very strange moon, Pennsylvania, which has been rumored, in my research anyway, it's kind of an eerie echo of Area 51 around the moon. But that thing crashes, and all the reports are it looks like an acorn with hieroglyphs on it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've got 7,000 townspeople who are like, yeah, this crashed there, and the army came and got it.
Yep.
It was tracked, etc. Later, they try to blow it off and say, oh, it was space garbage, you know, whatever.
But they try to pass it off as a crashed Russian satellite, too.
Yes, exactly. Right. The good old space fence wasn't working there. NORAD tracked it. This thing went down hardcore. One of the people who came close to it said it was basically smoking, you know. And so it when it crashed, there was that kind of reaction, you know, fire and smoke. And they thought it was a plane crash. They got really close and they started to see, oh, this thing is like hieroglyphs on it. It's this weird shape. And so there's too many good eyewitnesses for that. Now, if you backtrack, you've got the mysterious disappearance of the most advanced Nazi project, which is Die Glocke. Mm-hmm. Now, you've done the most extensive research on it. I want you to restate that research on it just to give us an idea of what it is. And then we'll take it and see what became of the Bell.
Well, the Bell was the, according to Witkowski, and people have to understand, the story of the Bell was broken by a Polish researcher by the name of Igor Witkowski. So the source of the story comes down to one source.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the first problem that I had in investigating the story is, okay, we've got this fantastic, phenomenal story. I have no way of traveling to Poland and looking at the archives or anything else. So how do I verify the story? So my approach has always been like that of a lawyer, arguendo. What must be true in order for this story to be true? So you have to look at the details that Witkowski has in his writings about the Bell. And most of it is in a wonderful book, by the way, called The Truth About the Wunderwaffe. So Witkowski has several details about the Bell. It's about 15 feet tall. It's about 12 feet wide. It's shaped like a bell or like an acorn, if you wish. Inside of this device, which is probably of some sort of ceramic nature, the cover, inside of this device, you had two counter-rotating cylinders, mechanically rotating cylinders, into which they put a serum that was codenamed Serum 525. Which, according to Witkowski, was a heavy, cherry red, gooey liquid.
Huh.
Okay. And they spun it up in opposite directions. In other words, the cylinders were counter-rotating. And then they pulsed it with extreme amounts of high-voltage electricity. We know it was high voltage because, first of all, it was... The facility where this was being tested had its own electrical power plant. So that tells me that they're using enormous amounts of high voltage direct current electricity. That's why the power plant is there. If you don't know what direct current does, the amount of electricity at the load end in direct current drops off very dramatically over the distance from the source of the power.
So you've got to be right close to that power plant.
Okay. So they're using direct current electricity with this substance as they're rotating it up and pulsing it with gobs of electric current. And as a result, this thing levitated, according to Vitkovsky's recounting of the story. And that's all it did. It just levitated. It didn't dart all over, you know, and all this other stuff. And in the some of the first tests, it actually caused some of the scientists to die. So in other words, it gave off deadly radiation. All right. So those are your data points. Now, what I did was I took each of those data points in my books about the Bell, and I attempted to reverse engineer each data point and why the Germans are doing it, and do so in terms that made sense with the scientific literature of the day. That's what I attempt to do. Okay.
Right.
When you do it that way, the story makes sense.
And you've got data. Yeah.
You've got data that you can reverse engineer. One of the things I came to the conclusion was that this serum, you know, putting other dots and clues together with this serum 525, this heavy cherry red gooey liquid that they're spinning up. Well, why are you pulsing that? Why are you rotating, counter rotating it and pulsing it with gobs of a direct current? Well, the pulsing suggests to me you're using that substance as a fuel for a plasma.
Oh.
And by counter rotating it, you're trying to create a differential rotation in that plasma, like what you have in the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And by that counter rotation of a plasma, you're hoping to get some sort of energy and contrabaric effect. You're trying to get an energy source and you're trying to get a gravitational phenomenon out of it, which with the levitation you're doing. This serum is in my opinion cherry red because it's a compound of mercury thorium oxide. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Mercury is a perfect source for a plasma. It would be liquid and it would be very heavy, and in any sort of oxide form, it would be red. Okay.
Thorium. Aren't there Hindu texts that reference mercury being used
in vortices?
Yes. Okay.
Bingo. The Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely they do. So if you're the Nazis and you've been reading these texts and
suddenly.
And the head of the project is the scientist by the name of Dr. Walter Gerlach, who publishes before the war a little article about, hey, you know, in our experiments with mercury plasma, we've been noticing little trace amounts of gold at the end of the experiment.
Oh,
wow. You know, so it goes. So the Nazis were also, unbeknownst to most people, they were not only enriching uranium on an absolutely enormous scale. And I know that sounds completely contradictory to the Allied legend after the end of the war, but trust me, they were enriching uranium on an enormous scale. Enormous. Wow. But they were also stockpiling thorium. Well, one of the Germans after the war said, well, we were using it as a whitening ingredient in toothpaste.
Wow. What is thorium used for?
Not that. they were probably using it as a fuel for a reactor, but I think also they were separating out thorium-229 isomer. All right, now, got to bear with me here. An isomer is a special kind of isotope where the nucleus is in an extremely high state of spin. It's spinning like nobody else's business. And at a certain threshold, you can put on the brakes and get it to stop. And when it stops, an isomer will spit out gobs of radioactivity, mostly in the form of gamma rays, by the way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, so it's kind of a perfect way, if you stop and think about it, to create the radiation pressure necessary to set off a hydrogen bomb without an atom bomb.
Oh, right. Right.
Now, Ripple, here we go. So, thorium 229 isomer is an isomer whose threshold of stability is very low. In other words, it's very easy to stop that nucleus from spinning and getting it to spit out gobs of radiation, like getting the nucleus pulsed with gobs of direct current electricity. Okay. So in other words, I'm really trying to reverse engineer every little detail of this device. Thorium oxide would also be heavy and cherry red. And in a compound with mercury, you would have a perfect plasma making inducing fuel. So I go so far as to imply that this substance might have been the ultimate reality behind all of those 1990s myths about red mercury being that substance that so right. many people were trying to get yeah. that could set off thermonuclear, in other words, a hydrogen bomb, without the need of an atom bomb as the mm-hmm. fuse. Okay. So I think,
which would be an incredible innovation.
Oh, yeah. It's an innovation that basically would make thermonuclear war fightable. You know, mm-hmm. because you're not dealing with gobs of fallout at that point.
Right, exactly.
You just got a big bang, and, you know, that's yeah. about it.
We went so deep with this in the Ripple episode right. that you and I did. There's so many questions. We'll do a follow-up on Ripple for people right. who are concerned about that. But this, I think, is fascinating.
Yeah, well, because, this is the tie-in to Ripple. Yes. That's what I'm getting yeah. at here. So the Bell thing was such an exotic technology from any way you slice it. It's the only technology that Witkowski found, and he reproduces this document in his book, The Truth About the Wunderwaffe. It's a letter from Abraham Azaw, who was the head of the nuclear part of all these black projects. He's a physicist. It's a letter from Abraham Azaw to the Gestapo. And it's on Reich Marshal Hermann Goering's stationery. So in other words, this is being done with Reich Marshal Goering's personal approval. You know, he's not letting his stationery out for people to use and right, yeah. sign documents on. So anyway, Azaw writes the Gestapo demanding that they release a scientist by the name of Dr. Richard Kramer, who's one of these Bell scientists, because he had been denounced, here it comes, by Kurt Davis.
Oh.
Wow. The plot just thickened quite a lot, didn't it?
denounced
to the Gestapo by Kurt Davis. And by the way, that denunciation was why the U.S. Army counterintelligence reopened his file once he was a paperclip scientist in this country.
Interesting.
So in other words, the Bell story now is directly connected to a paperclip scientist who, by the way, let's just remember, ends up in charge of the Apollo flights.
Right. Okay?
And then yeah. retires to end up as the head of NASA's UFO desk.
Okay? Yes, he's the UFO file man.
He's the UFO file guy. Golly, go this figure guy. Why that. Yeah, this guy. So they're writing to get this scientist released from the Gestapo, and in his letter to the Gestapo, Azaw says he is necessary for a project that is Kriegsentscheidend, which is the German technical term for decisive for the war. Mm. And Witkowski points out in his book, where he's detailing all these fantastical Nazi wonder weapons technologies like cruise missiles and television-guided missiles, acoustic homing torpedoes, ramjet-powered artillery projectiles, you name it, they're doing it. Azaw writes that this project that Kramer is involved with is decisive for the war, and it's the only project that he ever encounters amid all this other stuff, including A-bombs and H-bombs, that is listed Kriegsentscheidend.
Incredible.
In other words, this is the very pinnacle of all the other weird stuff.
Wow.
That the Nazis
decisive
are doing.
For the war, they were yeah. planning to use the Bell as a weapon.
Yeah, I think ultimately this is, you know, Nazis are Nazis. They're not going to be interested right. in anything.
Everything's going to be
weaponized, it, you know. But yeah, it would have been a technology that would have given them access to energy. Mm-hmm. It would have been a technology that would have given them access. In other words, it's a kind of unified technology. It would have given them access to advanced systems of propulsion. And of course, it could be weaponized.
Right.
So it's a kind of prototypical technology with lots of possible uses. And this is why they're so interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pouring, you know, big money. Obviously, if you're building electrical power plants in the middle of nowhere to supply this thing, you're putting big money into it.
And Hitler, at this point, he's set. He has his heart set on a Wunderwaffe that will change the course of the war, because they're starting to lose badly, and it's only through something extraordinary that they're going to regain the initiative.
Yes. Yeah. And if you look at Hitler's statements at the end of the war, clearly the guy is either nuts or he's talking out of knowledge. He mentions, we just need to hang on for a little bit longer. And when we do, we will have the means to pull this thing out. And, I don't necessarily think he's referring simply to the bell. He could be referring to a lot of these things. But certainly, I don't think, just given the nature of the Nazi hierarchy, I don't think that Hitler could not have not been aware of that project.
Absolutely.
Not with Kommler in charge of it, no.
Well, it's fascinating because it's sort of like their ultimate secret project.
Yes, yeah,
it is. There is that statement that John Warner made that where he talks about his grandfather, Paul Mellon, going in and checking out what they had after the war and standing on this saucer-shaped construction that was a football field and a half in diameter. So obviously they had things which were left out of the record books rather dramatically, but the bell is fascinating. Yeah. The bell comes to us because of the reunification of Germany. Yes. The knowledge comes to us as a result of that.
Everything that I've mentioned in just this talk, the thorium-229 isomer, their uranium enrichment. And by the way, folks, I think the Nazis actually had a prototypical laser isotope enrichment technology. And the reason why I think that are the statements that some of those Nazi scientists made after the war as they're being secretly recorded by the British. So in other words, they not only had an enrichment technology, they had the most efficient enrichment technology to this day that you can think of.
Yeah. And we don't get the laser until 1958.
Well, I think they had that too. And the reason why the story is so garbled, the physics for the laser, Daniel, existed in the mid-1930s. Mm-hmm. So why did it take 30 years to invent? Well, it took 30 years to invent because the Nazis invented it and they were using it to enrich isotope. And we don't want that story to get out.
Oh, wow.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes.
Okay, that's what's going on here. So you're right. The German reunification is the thing that kicks all of this stuff loose. Everything that I've just told you about, ramjet-guided artillery projectiles, acoustic homing torpedoes, television-guided cruise missiles, little tiny silicon chips that are integrated circuits, if you look at them, vacuum tubes the size of the end of my pinky finger, the Allied and American equivalent of which was 10 times bigger at the end of the war, miniaturized television cameras, something called optical telephony, laser isotope enrichment, the bell, death rays, on and on and on and on it goes. Even the Type 21 U-boat that came out right at the end of the war, the world's first really true submarine. It was designed to spend most of its time underwater, not on the surface, unlike every other country's submarine. Why? Mm. Well, look at the thing. You can tell it's a revolution in design. But that submarine had the ability to fire torpedoes simply by acoustic location alone. They didn't even need to raise the periscope. Why? Because microphones were placed around the hull of the submarine that allowed you to determine the direction of a ship by sonar absolutely flawlessly and point and aim the submarine.
Remarkable.
It's just crazy stuff.
And they have kind of a prototype of the cell phone as well.
And yeah.
These guys are ready to roll.
These guys are ready to rock and roll, you know. And this stuff, by the way, is all kind of entering its prototypical fruition and development right as 1944 closes and 45 rolls in. So in other words, it's all coming to fruition at the end of the war. You know, I mentioned the Junkers 390 earlier, this enormous six-engine aircraft. Right.
They were going to dominate in flight, you know.
Well, the Junkers 290 and the Junkers 390 were some of the first aircraft in the world, Daniel, that were capable, here it comes, of mid-air refueling.
Oh, wow. So advanced. It really is. if we were to take the Bell, it's very interesting because of its scientific contribution. It stands out as something that was left out of the typical progression of science, obviously, whatever they did with it.
Uh-huh.
Now, the outcome of the Bell, as you've tracked it, and you've tracked it, I think, better than anyone. I read a book dealing with Kommler and talked even with some of the authors about it. Mm-hmm. And although they were very, very well informed on certain things, they missed the steps that you were talking about in relation to the Bell. What happened to the Bell? Now the Allies are closing in. It's looking bad. Hitler's in the bunker thinking, how am I going to get out of here? And they're starting to make plans.
Yeah.
We're gonna move. The rat lines are going to get operational. We're going to move this stuff out of here. So the Bell, one of the terrible tragedies we hear in relation to the Bell is that the people working on it weren't going to be allowed to go any further with their lives because of the knowledge that they held.
Yeah, the SS murdered 60 of the scientists and technicians involved with the project at the end of the war. In other words, the Nazis did not want anyone, Soviets, Americans, British, French, whoever, to learn anything about this project.
Incredible.
The only reason that we know about it is an SS general by the name of Jakob Sporenberg, according to Igor Witkowski, was hauled up by a Polish war crimes tribunal after the war and tried for the murder of those 60 scientists, because at that time, the murders occurred in that part of Germany that subsequently became part of Poland after the war. So Poland asserted jurisdiction. And Sporenberg admitted to killing these 60 scientists and technicians. And most of the information that we have about that project ostensibly comes from Sporenberg's affidavit to this Polish war crimes court. That's Witkowski's story. Again, we have no way to verify. No one has ever seen this affidavit. So again, we have to take the details of the story itself and say, do they make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion, they do. Okay. But I leave it for readers to judge that for themselves. Now, what happened to it at the end of the war? We have to remember, and I've talked about this in the Nazi books, Martin Bormann had set up a meeting at the Hotel Maison Rouge in Strasbourg, France, where he plotted with German captains of industry to get all of this technology, the patents, the papers, the technical drawings, the money, you know, any liquid asset he could think of, from cash to jewelry to blueprints, drawings, stock certificates, you name it. He was trying to get all of this out of Nazi Germany, and of course, all the secret research as well.
Right.
When you look at, and I've said this before, when you look at how the Nazis are driving the divisions of the spoils at the end of the war, it's very clear what they're doing. They're making sure that the United States and the West get the creme de la creme of the big names involved in the major publicly known projects like the rockets, the A-bomb, you know, all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. They're making sure the Soviets get the middle echelon managers, draftsmen, technicians that can reconstruct the paper trail for all this stuff.
Yeah.
So they're setting up a stalemate. But the most exotic stuff, like the Bell, they keep to themselves. In my opinion, and there's people that disagree with me out there, researchers that have disagreed. I suspect that you've, the people that you were talking about with their book are some of the American authors that maintain Comer and the Bell came to this country. You can make that case. You can. But there is another case to be made if you pay attention to the people in Argentina, which most American authors do not do. I do. Because some of those authors, first of all, tell you that, yeah, we saw one of those big Junker 390s things landing right here in this airfield. By the way, that 390 was subsequently taken apart by the Argentinians because the dang plane is so big, you can't hide it. So, so their way of hiding it was simply to take it apart, you know. But, yeah, I think Comler and the Bell, the technology behind the Bell and whatever documentation accompanied it, probably made their way to Argentina. The reason I think that is if you look at the research going on in Argentina with Dr. Richter after the war, aspects of that research are coming directly out of the same concepts that are behind the Bell, like rotating a plasma, subjecting it to intense electrical arcing, and so on and so forth. Well, this is what Richter is doing. So I think the argument has to be made that, yeah, you can make any argument you wish, but if you ignore the possibility that it went to Argentina, you're ignoring a significant feature of the story. One that, incidentally, if you really trace it out, even makes sense of the aftermath of the Air Force's reaction to Roswell. And, you know, I lay out that case in Roswell.
Oh, right? Interesting. So I think they might have been thinking this is part of the project that we lost track of there at the end.
Absolutely. When you look at the authentic version of that general, I forget what his name is, not Twining, the general that puts out the Air Force Intelligence Collection Memorandum in the aftermath of Roswell.
Right.
When you read the authentic version and then the doctored version, there's a doctored version, and that's the one ufology cites the most because that's the one that sneaks in ETs in the midst of a document that's talking about we need to find out where the Horton brothers are. What do the Horton brothers have to do with ET?
Oh, answer, yes. Nothing.
But the Horton brothers have a lot to do with all of this secret Nazi research. Well, where are they? Well, by the way, folks, they're in Argentina.
Good location.
Jet aircraft for Juan Perón. That's where they are. So in other words, something about that crash told the United States Air Force, this is all that Nazi crap that we, you know, saw and heard about, so on and so forth. So we got to figure out what's going on here. Would they keep that quiet? Yeah. Why? Nazis aren't supposed to be flying around, especially in New Mexico in 1947.
Right. Yeah.
The war is over, folks. You know, that's the problem. So we got to come up with a fast one to explain this. You know, let's blame it on extraterrestrials. And if that doesn't work, it's a weather balloon.
You know? Right. Yeah. It's interesting, too, because that period, even the fact that they raised the possibility that there's anything Nazi about it, it's very strange because the Nazis have been defeated for 2 years. So even for it to be raised, even if it were innocuous and ridiculous, the fact that they're raising it means they know that these guys are up to something as a kind of extraterritorial type state.
Bingo. That's precisely the argument in my books. The Nazis keep the most exotic stuff for themselves because they have created a financial infrastructure, first of all, to continue investigating it after the war. And the reason they're doing that is, okay, if you're Dr. Strangelove and you're able to get your hands on an exotic technology, well, yeah, we will rule the world, you know. Mm-hmm. there you go.
Exactly. What happens theoretically to the developments? Now, we started with Kexburg, and Kexburg is absolutely a bona fide case, as I mentioned. It's not something that somebody could say, oh, it was a hoax or whatever. No, it's, you know, too many witnesses, too much action. Uh-huh. So that thing, Acorn style, but of course it's Bell style. It looks like the Bell that we're talking about here.
It even has the same dimensions.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, I have to do this here because, to my knowledge, I think I'm the only one to notice the resemblance of the Bell story to the Kexburg story. Okay, mm-hmm. I think I'm the only one, and it mystifies me as to why no one else has picked this up. Mm-hmm. Not even Stan Gordon, the guy that has investigated Kexburg.
You know, most
of what we know is because of Stan Gordon's research,
right?
And, you know, they put out this cockamamie idea that was a Soviet Cosmos satellite that crashed, which might explain some of the aspects of the story, but not all of them. Mm-hmm. And here's why. In the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, remember, I have a map of the track of the Kexburg UFO.
Mm-hmm.
And where is it coming from? Well, it's coming from Canada.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. And then it gets over Ohio. I think it's Ohio or Indiana, where it makes a little bend.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a satellite crashing to Earth is not going to make a bend.
There's no direction there. Yeah.
No, it's not going to do that unless it's under the Soviets' control, you know, mm-hmm. which is probably unlikely.
Yeah.
So this thing makes a bend, and then after the bend, it crashes in the field in Pennsylvania. So it's under some sort of control. Mm-hmm. And then, lo and behold, the American military shows up within a couple of hours and nabs it out from under everybody, and off it goes to Dayton, Ohio.
Yes.
Where it's seen by somebody delivering ceramic bricks.
Mm.
Now, that's part of the story. Because the original Bell was tested underground in a facility that was lined with ceramic bricks and rubber mats.
Hmm.
So in other words, whoever, what I'm suggesting is that the Kexburg Acorn is either the Bell or an iteration of Bell-like technology, and they knew they had to have the ceramic bricks in order to store.
They knew, thing. Yeah. They knew. The native habitat for the Bell.
Bingo.
They needed, yeah.
Bingo.
So that report is an incredible crisscross. That ties the Bell closer with the Kexburg object.
Oh, absolutely it does. Now, one final little pièce de résistance. But as mm-hmm. you know, I drop clues in my books to see if anybody's really paying attention. No one has paid attention to this one.
Uh-oh.
Why is it coming from Canada?
Yes,
why it's coming from Canada? Why from there? It's coming, incidentally, from a region, when you trace the track back, will land you in along that area of countryside between Alberta and British Columbia, you know, that very beautiful area there. It's coming from that region. Now, if you know anything, I can tell you that there are stories, UFO stories, out of British Columbia after the war. In fact, I even know the certain little town, and I'm not going to mention what it is, but there's a certain little town in British Columbia where a lot of these stories come out of. Hmm. By the way, there's a big German community there.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, yeah, ain't it? So there it is, folks. There's my little data point for all of you snoopers and sniffers who want a story to follow. I well, just that gave is you interesting. One for free.
Yes. So yeah. In the middle of that, you could have in these communities some of the advanced guys over there doing these tests undercover because it's all kept protected by the community of Germans.
It's all kept protected, and, you know, something like that, all you need is an underground facility and gobs of power.
Mm-hmm. Wow, absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
Now, what they were developing there was plasma and a kind of torsion physics, as you've described.
Yes. Yeah.
You bring that into the future. We might be seeing a test there with the Kecksburg incident. Something goes wrong, that thing comes down.
Or American intelligence managed to take over control of it and bring it down.
Knock it down. It. Yeah. Grab it. Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh.
And it's diverted one way or another, whatever it was doing. This is very strange, though, because it's an unusual object, even for the UFO field.
Oh, absolutely.
It's not a it's not a saucer. You always hear about the saucers crashes. You know, you might even get the cigar shaped sighting, whatever it is. This thing with the bell shape is very unusual for UFO. Let's face it. And what is the possibility there that you're putting out that the basically over the 20 year stretch from when their last bell tests are going on in Germany and they take it out to Argentina, that they develop it in Argentina for 20 years, bring it up this way, and then start to test it over the United States?
Well, it could be, it could very easily be possible.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I think that it might be possible is that there are the occasional rare reports within ufology of similar types of craft that have been observed that don't fill the typical saucer, cigar, you know, the two shapes that seem to be the most associated, and it's not a triangle, you know. So those are the three shapes that we hear about the most. But there are occasional UFO stories where you're dealing with something very, very different. One of the most famous that comes to my mind is that case of the New Mexico policeman, Lonnie Zamora.
Yes.
That encountered this egg-like thing out in the desert, sitting on the ground on a tripod of legs, and two guys in silver suits, you know, outside of this thing, doing something. And they get, when they see him, they get back in, and it roars off. And that's the sound he describes it making. It's a roar.
He describes what looks like exhaust, which is exhaust, even weirder.
Yeah, it's very weird for, you know, a flying saucer. But in New Mexico, so again, you know, I tend to think that at some point the United States got wind either by capturing the technology, or the Germans let them a part of it, or we stole it, or put two and two. You know, there's any number of routes that this could have taken. I personally think that by the Apollo moon landings, one of my hypotheses has always been that some sort of deal was struck between America and its space program and these post-war Nazis for access to that technology. Because I think it's that technology that got us through the Van Allen belts, got us down on the moon, and then most importantly, got us off the moon.
Fascinating. That would explain a lot, because these other countries, you know, especially the Soviet Union at the time, and then when that becomes Russia, they never land on the moon with a manned
mission. Well, the Soviets landed on the moon, but it was never a manned mission. They landed some probes on the moon.
Yes.
But they, interestingly enough, the Soviets had the same problem that we did initially with their unmanned probes. Some of the probes would slam into the moon, you know, they'd literally crash into it. Some would just fly right by it. And the same thing happened to us on a number of occasions. And what that tells me is all of their calculations about gravity were wrong. That's what that tells
me. Yeah.
You know, we're off here, folks. There's something wrong. You know, it's not doing its 1/6 gravity thing correctly.
Well, if you've got a 1969 moon mission from the United States, manned with astronauts and all the rest,
that's time to land on the moon on July 20th. Or pardon me.
Yes. There's a great harkening back date.
There's right there. A little anniversary on that date, folks. Yes.
I found the eagle has landed, yeah.
I found a very strange article that you're going to be interested in, I believe, which talks all about how there is no picture of Neil Armstrong, the first man on the moon.
And because they're bothered by this question when it first starts. And he gets
so
bothered.
Wait a minute. Stanley Kubrick faked that too?
What's interesting is the reporters get to Armstrong and they're like, you have to tell us the story. What did you do? Throw the camera to the other astronaut? And he said, no, there are no pictures of me landing on the moon.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's another one of those stooged moments. But I want to ask you this in relation to this, because that Van Allen belt part is fascinating too. But just in terms of the logic of history, wouldn't it follow that, like everything else, we develop the atomic bomb and then the Russians develop the atomic bomb, the Chinese and all the rest. So we do it. We go up there to the moon with a manned mission. We get off, we come back. But nobody else has been able to pull that off. I find that very strange, bizarre, historic anomaly. They're always able to do this kind of, you know, espionage and all the rest. Why is it they miss here? Nobody else has landed on the moon.
My answer to that, it's complex. The Soviets were unsuccessful with their, I think it was called the N1 rocket, which was their equivalent of the Saturn V. Mm-hmm. They did build it. They did test it. I think it was either the first or the second test blew up on the pad.
Yes. Wow. I mean,
this enormous rocket and it's blowing up on the pad. That's
incredible.
That's a big explosion.
You know? So yeah.
I've always thought that it, given the fact that the Soviets were that close, I mean, neck and neck, I've always thought that that smacks too much like a convenient bit of sabotage to me.
Absolutely.
The other countries, Japan, China, India, that have Europe that have sent probes to the moon, they've been successful in landing. The reason why they don't send manned missions is, in my opinion, probably they have not invested heavily in manned spaceflight, and probably simply put for budget expenses. Now, it may also be that they don't think they have the technology to get them through the Van Allen belts.
That's it.
Which to me is a non-starter of an argument.
Mm-hmm.
And it always has been. Because if you're that concerned, you don't have to fly through the Van Allen belts to get to the moon. You can do a polar, you know, go mm-hmm. out of your way and simply go through the holes in the Van Allen belts if you're that concerned. And again, I think that's a non-starter of an argument.
Mm.
Because the bottom line here, folks, is that radiation, exposure to radiation, is a simple function of the amount that you're exposed to and the duration of time over which the exposure occurs.
Right.
And as far as I know, all those people arguing that you can't get through the Van Allen belts, they have yet to show me a calculation of the amount of radiation those astronauts would have absorbed on the flight to the moon. And the other problem here is, as I keep pointing out, if you're dealing with an advanced technology like the Bell, features of which function rather similar to a Faraday cage,
mm-hmm.
you might have a technology that really makes the problem of the Van Allen belts irrelevant. This has always been my problem with that explanation. There's any number of ways that they might have decided to solve that problem, and I haven't heard the hoax crowd come up with any of them, you know, because they're just bound and determined to say that we never went. That doesn't mean that it was not a peculiar and precarious operation. I think it's a much better explanation that comes mm-hmm. from Richard Hoagland. And his explanation all along has been they got there and they discovered that they were flying through an immense field of debris above the surface of the moon that is not visible to us. Mm. Why is it not visible? It's glass. Well, why glass? Well, glass in a vacuum is as hard as steel.
Mm.
You know, it doesn't operate the same way as it does here on Earth in an atmosphere where it breaks. Yeah, it's very interesting.
Why wouldn't they reveal that?
I don't know. Partly, again, I think it's this mentality. Well, we've got to go find Atlantis and any advanced technology. If you've all of a sudden landed in the middle of a field and you can look off here or over there and see little indications of possible artificiality, then you're really landing in a junkyard. Mm-hmm. And you want to keep that classified because there might be technology. If their people are advanced enough to have something up there, or even worse, as the Soviets concluded, we're advanced enough to fly the dang thing there and park it there.
Right.
You've got a problem, you know.
It's interesting when you mentioned Van Allen there, because it's Van Allen and Berkner who worked together to stage the International Geophysical Year, which I think is a gigantic cover story for testing that whole advanced technology in Antarctica. And of course, Berkner and the UFO file, Berkner going to meet JFK, you know, JFK's on his way there. We know that this is a function of history, but it's interesting that Van Allen, he's right there, and Berkner is the one whispering in Kennedy's ear, this is the moon Mars mission. Go out there and say, we choose to go to the moon and Mars. So they had that dialed in. And it's interesting to me that Gordon Cooper, in his autobiography, there's so many things to go into in that Cooper biography, but I'll say this. When he talks about von Braun coming up to him in the mid 60s and saying, you're going to lead the mission to Mars, get fit. Get ready. And then he says later, someone taps him on the shoulder and says, remember what von Braun told you? Don't talk about it. Don't think about it. And don't repeat it, whatever you do.
Right.
And that's the end of that. Then he hears there's a mission being set up. He even knows some of the people involved who were going there in 1981. What happened to the Mars missions, Joseph? Did they happen? Are they part of the secret space program?
I've always entertained the possibility that, you know, that they went. It's just that they went secretly.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that part of that secrecy surrounds the technology to get us there.
Wow.
In other words, it's not so much that we wouldn't want to disclose, hey, we've gone to Mars. We just don't want to disclose how we got there. Because if we went, the idea that we did it on a chemical rocket,
mm-hmm.
taking, you know, at a minimum 6 to 8 months, you know, if we're planning the launch at the right window, and then another 6 to 8 months after a 6 month stay on the planet, you know, to get back.
Yeah.
The idea that you're going to do this with chemical rockets, like a big version of the Saturn V, ain't going to wash.
Mm-hmm.
Ain't going to happen. It just is not going to happen. So you need and by the way, the same thing for all this nonsense talk about asteroid mining. You're going to do all that with a chemical rocket? You know,
no way.
So in other words, the fact that they're talking about this, forget those cute NASA drawings of Dixie cups and solar panels collecting rocks out in the asteroid belt and then zipping back on a chemical rocket to the moon to mine, you know, just nuttery. So the fact that they're talking about it at all.
But you're shooting down Elon Musk's fantasy.
Well, no, I'm not shooting it down. I'm just telling you that it ain't going to happen with a rocket, Elon, and you know it.
Yeah, he knows.
He knows it.
Yeah.
Everybody knows it. So here's the problem. If you're going to get there, you have to have some sort of exotic technology to do it. The least exotic of which is an ion propulsion or you know, plasma fusion motor or something like that. That's the least exotic. And even that's going to take some time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I look at all of this and I'm thinking, okay, if they went to Mars, it has to be exotic. And if it's exotic, they're not going to talk about it.
Right. Right.
We do have that weird indicator from Alternative 3.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Or, you know, the whole Alternative 3 thing is about a secret space program and secret flights and bases on Mars.
That is 1979.
That's 1979 and batch consignments.
Wow.
What are Baskin signs? They're the people abducted for the slave labor to run the whole program.
Mm.
What are we dealing with all over the world right now?
Missing human trafficking.
Trafficking, the whole nine yards. Yeah. So alternative three, you know, I get the creepy feeling that those guys at ITV, they were letting a cat out of the bag, either deliberately or inadvertently, but they let it out of the bag. And part of that show, if you recall, Daniel, was they interview this academic for some Royal Society of whatever, and the academic is telling them, well, you know, it appeared to us that at some deep level, and you can see him kind of hesitate, that at some deep level, there was an element of coordination between the United States and the Soviet Union in their space programs.
Mm.
Well, I took that and ran with it, Daniel, in SS Brotherhood of the Bell.
Mm-hmm.
Because you recall, I posted the schedules of early 1960s launches of unmanned probes to the moon. And what do you see? Well, the Soviets launch two or three, bing, bing, bing. Then they stop. The United States launches two or three. Then we stop. Back to the Soviets. The Soviets launched two or three more, and they stopped.
Mm.
Back to the United States. We launched two or three, and then we stopped. So in other words, you just look at the schedule.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's this weird trade-off. You would think that if they're in a space race, they're going to be launching more or less at the same time and more or less consistently and more or less constantly.
Right, right.
But that's not what you see.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Wow.
So think of it what you will.
That is absolutely fascinating.
It is.
And of course, this is what Kennedy proposed in the first place and why he reached such deep, deep opposition. No space race, coordination in space, joint moon mission. And it's very interesting because there are aspects there that suggest everybody on the side of the leadership was on board on the Soviet Union and the American side, but the factions that wanted to control where that space development went got rid of Khrushchev, assassinated Kennedy. Yeah.
Yeah. This is how important with coordination, but John, you just let the cat out of the bag and we're not ready for that.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Right.
Off you go.
Yeah. You're opening up the UFO file. No, no, no,
no. Especially if you've got Nazis involved.
Mm hmm.
You mm-hmm. want to be partners with the hated Soviet Union?
Yeah. Hello, Walter Dornberger. Right?
Hello, Walter Dornberger. Yeah.
And it's still incredible, the combination there, as you've pointed out, of the White Russians, the Minsk, Belarus, you know, factor that wanted the Nicholas Rain back. They wanted the money back. They wanted the power back. And communism and the Soviets were the anathema to them.
And DeMorenschild. So
making deals with them, forget it.
Yeah, DeMorenschild, White Russian.
Exactly. Right in the heart of it.
Right in the heart of it.
Dornberger and the White Russians very comfortable with the Dornberger Nazi aspect. They both want the same thing.
Oh, they were raising units for the Waffen-SS. There were yellow Russian units of the Waffen-SS.
Yes.
So, you know, there's nothing new in geopolitics. What we're seeing now between Russia and the Ukraine, this is an old story, folks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it goes back a lot of it to World War II, some of it to World War I even. So, you know, it's not a new story.
That's what's so difficult when people approach and, you know, they had all the committees in 2025 doing the JFK aspect, and they couldn't get anywhere near the truth of anything. It was a dismal display.
Well, you're dealing with people, Daniel, that haven't read.
Yeah.
I mean, not one of those congressmen or senators has read any book on the JFK assassination other than maybe a reinforcement of the official narrative.
Right.
Have any of them familiarized themselves with Mae Brussels' research on it? Probably not.
Oh,
they probably don't even know who she is. you know.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. She's one of the best of all time.
And she's one of the best of all time, you know. Harold Weisberg, you know, all these early JFK researchers, do any of these people know who they are? Have they read their works?
I thought the perfect opportunity to take Professor Scott before the committee.
Bingo.
In his 90s, he's sharper than any of those Congress guys.
Yeah. And talk about a guy that's done some research, you know, and are any of them interested? No, of course not. That's why all of this stuff to me is just, you know, these so-called UFO hearings. Has there been any mention of any of the more credible and capable UFO researchers in any of those hearings? Donald Kehoe, Morris Jessup, Paris Flamand, Long John Nabel, the guy wrote the textbook on it. And these people are utterly absent in hearings that were given a bunch of shills with handlers very clearly sitting right behind them, making sure they don't cross certain boundaries. You know, come on, give me a break, folks. You can do better, CIA.
No question. No question. Yeah, they have to have their agents up there getting them ready to get that Paramount and Sony contract ready to help out Steven Spielberg with the next movie, you know.
Oh, you know, there's been a book that just came out, and I got it. I received it. It's about, I don't know who the author is, and it's a book about the Nazi UFO thing. Mm-hmm. And they devote a whole chapter in there to me. And
excellent.
I haven't read it yet, but, but I'm getting the impression that anybody who thinks the Nazis achieved anything in these fields is a Nazi sympathizer. So that's me, folks. Nazi sympathizer. Come on, people, read the books.
That's great. Well, we're going to touch on that again because there's so much more to bring out about your Templar research. And I think that that's so interesting that the Germans and the Nazi fascination, again, they had the Arthurian fascination, but the Templar fascination, I think, really pays off. And some of the stories that you've told about that really, I think, is highly indicative of the fact that they had the deeper histories. They were getting them from somewhere. Yeah.
Oh, well, one definite source that they're getting them from is the Teutonic Knights.
Yes.
Because the electors of Brandenburg, in other words, you know, the kings of Prussia, Kaiser, and so on, they're grand masters of the Teutonic Order, hereditarily.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, all of that Teutonic Knights archive are basically in the hands of the Kaiser. If you want to get right down to it.
What do you think of the stories of Himmler using the skull of the Teutonic Knight and having the elite of the SS circle around it?
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, that castle that you're talking about where he had all those rituals, Wewelsburg Castle, that is a museum now. You can actually go in there and look at that crypt.
Incredible.
You have to get special permission to do it because the German government is very, very sensitive about anything Nazi.
Yeah.
Yeah, they will ask why you want to go in there and what's the purpose, blah, blah, blah. But no, that ritual was definitely there. And the ritual itself was confined to Obergruppenführers or higher rank, in other words, basically to SS four-star generals. So Hans Kammler would have been one of these people that had gone through that ritual.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. And the messages that they would receive, that's part of the mystery school activity.
That's absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Himmler had all sorts of projects going on in the Annen Erbe that were just, you can't qualify them as anything other than black magic. Mm-hmm. One of the most famous experiments that he had the Annen Erbe conducting or performing was attempting to use pendulums, you know, put a pendulum on the end of a pen or a pencil, using pendulums over maps of the Atlantic Ocean, trying to find British convoys.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they did a lot of wild, kooky, crazy
stuff. Yeah. That's a deep occult tactic.
Well, that is, of course it is. It's a very deep occult tactic. And, you know, I keep telling people, if you're gonna throw the door open to every idea conceivable, you are going to have by far and away far more failures than successes.
Right, sure.
And unfortunately, the people that poo-poo all this stuff only point to the failures. They're not pointing to, you know, miniaturized television cameras, the first little indications of integrated circuits in 1940, you know, little vacuum tubes the size of your pinky finger, you know, all of this other stuff that, you know, they're wildly successful at.
And you could in some ways say that we're living in the German innovation. Once you get into the later 20th century, into the 21st century.
We are living inside the technology transfer from the end of World War II. That's it. That's what we're living in.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, Philo Farnsworth takes his television technology over to Nazi Germany, and they broadcast the Olympics with it.
In 1936.
You can go into little stores in Berlin that were kind of television movie theaters. They'd have a television set there, and they'd turn it on, and you could watch the Olympics.
14 years before we get it in America. What?
Yeah. Imagine turning on your television set, and you're seeing Dolph give a speech. Well, you know, from the movie, what is it, Contact, you actually see the television broadcast of Hitler opening the Olympic ceremony.
Yes.
That speech was on television.
I mean, it's incredible. And the idea of, you know, what it would have been in America, this is interesting about how things work. It was already operational. How did it not spread to America? There was obviously something in place that said, we're not dealing with this.
I am working on that right now.
Okay. Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm
interesting.
Researching another book.
Excellent. And Farnsworth is involved somehow.
Oh, yeah. Front and center, one might say.
Well, we can't wait. Joseph, it's incredible. And the research, phenomenal. Completely off the charts. Our discussion today into the outer spheres. Your last collection, the two-parter, incredible overview of the Civil War. And that's the most recent set. And you're going to be working now on this new one, Something About America.
It's a book I've had in the back of my head for about 12 to 15 years or so, but I haven't really figured out how to write it because I just can't find the primary source material to do it. So what I finally decided to do was I'm going to do the same thing I did with the bell itself. I'm going to do a kind of lawyer's arguendo case, you know, what needs to be true for these things to be out there. I'm going to have to make the case purely circumstantially.
Wow.
You know, I was lucky with the atom bomb because somebody sent me a copy of the Zinsser affidavit. And, oh, well, the Nazis blew off a bomb. Okay. You know. but no, it's a different kind of case I'm going to have to make with this. So,
well, the period that you're talking about, I'm going to mention something, which I discovered. It's very strange. Coolidge's vice president.
Dawes. Coolidge?
Coolidge, Calvin Coolidge.
Uh-huh.
His VP, Dawes.
Yeah, okay.
Set up the search for Atlantis in Honduras.
Oh, I didn't know that at all.
And there's a New York Times headline with Dawes saying, because the language is so similar in Honduras, the Maya part over in Egypt... Uh-huh. I think there's a connecting culture. He's Mr. Atlantis VP.
Oh, now that is, I did not know that, but that certainly puts.
So there's an awareness. There are breadcrumbs. There's like footprints of this group over time. One of the people who you might be surprised, you've never heard of probably, who was vice president of the United States.
under Calvin Coolidge in the 1920s. His name was Vice President Dawes. That's him there in Panama. And what do you think he's doing in Panama?
He's on a mission. He is searching.
He's searching. He's searching for Atlantis, which he did for a decade. And this is one of the guys who set up the Federal Reserve. He's a very deep player. And there are articles in the New York Times, Washington Post, and all the rest, all about his travels and his obsession with Atlantis. And he was going to be the president, in fact, in 1928, but there was the whole thing about the Depression and everything else, so he never got to run. But there you have the presidential level. If you look at Henry Wallace, who's the vice president under FDR, he's a theosophist, one. Two, he's on a search for Atlantis because he's realized that the Mayan language is so similar to the Egyptian language. And so there's this thread in politics through the secret societies and through these other groups, like we were talking about. I think Dawes is particularly interesting because one of the things that he did when he wasn't satisfied after a 10-year search was he petitioned the Vatican Library for all their information around Atlantis. And he sent a Yale researcher in there to get that information, and we never got anything from his report of what happened. But obviously there's some understanding that the Vatican archives hold the key to Atlantis.
Alan Coolidge, who's just about the last guy you'd think would put someone like that as a vice president.
No question. And he's part of the group that set up the Federal Reserve, Dawes.
Dawes, yes, I know he was.
Yeah.
Well, ain't that interesting?
I thought you'd get a kick on that.
Oh, no, I'm getting much more than a kick out of that. I'm writing that down because... Whoa. I've got to investigate that because that's right up the alley of this. I mean, Calvin Coolidge, of all people.
Good old Calvin.
Well, the guy wasn't a bad president. He really wasn't. But,
no, no.
But he was just sort of down to earth, you know?
He was. He went to school at UMass Amherst.
I know he did.
Yeah.
He was a New England born and bred.
He ironed his own socks, don't you know?
Oh, I can believe too. The guy was strange. I mean,
but he oversaw the Roaring Twenties, so.
Well, I know. You know, it's interesting because I'm reading Herbert Hoover's memoirs right now.
Oh, yeah.
He has some interesting things to say about President Coolidge. Wow. And even more interesting things to say about Roosevelt.
Oh, my God. This sounds like something. I can't wait to hear about this one. So
this is going to be a very difficult. I mean, you know, I've written some difficult books in my life that I've taken on these projects that I've had when I took them on. I'm thinking, how in the name of sense am I ever going to finish this, much less make it make sense? But no, this one is, but I've got to do it because there's a big problem that no one has confronted me with, and I figured I better write the book before they confront me with the problem.
Ah,
so you haven't talked about this, you know?
Yes, exactly. Wow, so incredible.
I talk about it.
But, well, it was a riveting education today. And of course, all of your work available at GizaDeathStar.com. Yep. Everyone should go there and start, you know, with the subject you're most interested in. But that the new books, of course, are always the most interesting. And the two Civil War volumes, Rialto and Richmond. And the second one, the follow-up, which is really fascinating as
Rialto
well.
Rialto and Richmond Reconstructed.
Reconstructed. The trail there of that period of Civil War America and the Reconstruction. I mean, just unbelievable. And you tackled it and brought it on. Of course, I always mention my favorite, the Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations. Fascinating. And you fuel the information, the ideas. The podcast world has yet to catch up with you. They're decades behind you with all the work. So, Joseph, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me back on. They may catch up with me because, so, you know, I just turned 69. I hope they become aware before I croak, you know.
You're 69
years young. Sorry,
I can't
attend your interview now. You know?
This is the perfect time. You've been battling it out in the shadows.
That's right.
It's great to see you, sir.
Good to see you, Daniel. Thanks for having me back on.
And you're back on shortly.
Okay.